The chances for peace in 1975 are just about as good as they are in the Middle East. That's the gauge. That's the place to look. That is the yardstick of measurement for the entirety of the world. And right now, the Arabs are girded for a new war and talking about their impatience for peace. They want the Israelis to give up the territorial acquisitions won since the 1967 war of Sinai, the West Bank, and the Golan Heights. And today, America, under the catalyst, perhaps, of the Arab oil embargo and the quadrupling of oil prices and the fact that we are so hooked to our dependency upon imported oil, as well as to our commitments to our North Atlantic partners and Japan in trading agreements between those nations, and the dramatic shift in American policy toward the Arab nations, and the same comment for Western Europe and Japan following the Yom Kippur War, it seems the United States now is more and more changing its policy toward Israel, trying to lean on Israel a little bit to get Israel to go along with certain concessions. Why won't the Israelis then give a little bit and be able in this point-by-point negotiation to give up the Golan Heights, major segments of the Sinai, perhaps the West Bank, for some free new country under the PLO? Well, in just a moment, I'm going to give you the overview, a little bit of a historical perspective of exactly why the Israelis cannot and will not negotiate on that basis. And therefore, why, if you use the Middle East as a microcosm for the rest of the world, there will be no peace in 1975. The Middle Eastern situation is so volatile that if this program is delayed even a day or two in the time between the time I tape it and the time you get to see it and hear it, the possibility of a new war breaking out is very real. It's just that volatile. Anything could happen at any time, with terrorist acts and then the retaliation for those acts continually, with the most incredible outpouring of wealth in the history of the entirety of the world into at least 80% of the OPEC membership of the Arab oil-rich Persian Gulf sheikdoms down there in about a year and a half, and the tremendous inpouring of gold and silver and monies from all over the world into that area with the economic chaos of the West as a direct result. All of these things happening and seeming to zero in the Middle East. American warship presence in the Indian Ocean, the appearance of the U.S. Super carrier, a nuclear carrier, the Constellation in the Persian Gulf that kind of rocked some of the Arab leadership. A recent statement by Mr. Kissinger that we would in fact use force in the gravest emergency, quoted in Business Week. The volatile and hate-filled reaction all across North Africa and from Iran, Iraq, and elsewhere as a result of those words. The threats of war from both sides. The pessimism in most places about war in the Middle East, and especially now a great deal of talk about nuclear weapons in the Middle East. All of this leads me to strongly believe that 1975 could be absolutely pivotal with regard to a nuclear bomb war and possibly an overture which would mark the beginning of a nuclear bomb World War III, even by accident if not by design, and that you need to understand the backdrop of all these events in the Middle East and in the light of Bible prophecy, because Bible prophecy does mean our day now. About a third of the Bible is prophecy, and it's written from the point of view ethnically, geographically, spiritually, historically, and prophetically, looking out at the rest of the world from Jerusalem. The Bible is a Middle Eastern book. It talks about the Middle East. The main prophecies of Jesus in the 24th chapter of Matthew and in Mark 13 and Luke 21 talk about Jerusalem. They talk about the Mount of Olives and Mount Zion, the place where Jerusalem is right now today, talking about the time in which you would see Jerusalem surrounded by armies as the key prophecy to know that some of these world cataclysms leading right toward a nuclear bomb World War III are about to occur. So let's get our perspective and see if we can understand what has been happening and what is happening in the Middle East right now. Is it so simple to say that the Arabs are impatient because the Israelis seem unwilling to negotiate over the return of the territories captured in the Jew-Arab Six-Day War of 1967? Let's go back and take a look at the Middle East in perspective. Israel is a tiny country that in 1967, about 12 to 15 kilometers wide at the waist, was completely surrounded by hostile Arab states. To the north, Lebanon and Syria, and further on away, Iraq, with Iran beyond. Jordan, along its border to the east, and of course the enclave that is now known as the West Bank, belonged to Jordan, as did the old city of Jerusalem in that time. To the south was Egypt and Yemen, Saudi Arabia. During that time, in 1966, just prior to the 67 war, when Israel, narrow at the waist, with the Sinai in Egyptian hands, Sharm el-Sheikh included, with its shipping going up from the Red Sea into the Gulf of Aqaba and into the port of Eilat, there was no peace. There was no peace in the kibbutzim and the beautiful verdant farmlands along the eastern shore of the Sea of Galilee, where Israeli farmers and tractors were out there with armor shield along. And when I was there in 1966 and went up and looked at these areas, and then later came back, as I've been to the Middle East so many times, both in the Arab states and on the Arab side, prior to the 67 war, when I had to go to Egypt and then to Lebanon and then over to Jordan, and then from Jordan to the old city of Jerusalem, walking through the Mandelbaum Gate and going to Israel. Why? Well, I had to, because if I had gone to Israel first and they had stamped my passport, the Arabs would never have allowed me to enter the Arab countries after they had known that I had been to Israel. The Israelis had a different point of view. They didn't care if I'd been to the Arab countries first. I was welcome in Israel. So I went there and I saw for my own eyes. I went to no man's land and looked over the border. I saw the guards with their submachine guns and their sandbags and so on. And I heard incidents even then of American tourists being wounded, in one case or two, killed along the border there with the Golan Heights to the north of the Sea of Galilee and along the ancient old city of Capernaum where that no man's land existed. Well, that was the way it was in 1966. There was no peace, yet the borders were exactly what the Arab countries want those borders to once again become. Along came the screams in the UN and Resolution 242. I have since obtained interviews from leaders from the Soviet Union, from leading Arab countries, as well as from the Israelis, about the way they interpret and want to apply that resolution so oft repeated in parlance in the United Nations 242, which calls for the Israelis to return to the pre-1967 Jew-Arab borders. The presupposition in all this is that if Israel will do that, and Barbara Walters on the Today Show wants to know, why won't you do that? Everybody wants to know, why won't the Israelis do that? Why, the assumption is, then we will have peace. But was there peace with those borders in existence, with those borders extant? You know, there's a great deal in all this that people seem to forget. First, Israel is surrounded by totally hostile states. Secondly, the fact is that none of those states, with the conceivable exception of Lebanon, have ever tasted the meaning of the word democracy. They are basically feudal and militaristic. It's almost true of them, as was said once of a Russian, he wasn't a king, but a Russian czar way back, that the state did not have an army, but that the army had a state. And that's just about true of Egypt and Saudi Arabia and so many other countries. They're feudal, totally militaristic, and they are bound together by one common objective, and that is hatred, animosity, vengeful desire to totally exterminate and to see to it that Israel simply does no longer exist. That is a common policy. Now, from the very day of the existence of Israel in 1948, one common policy has been closed frontiers, complete economic blockade, political pressure and propaganda, and a continual series of terrorist acts. All of these before any war we're talking about at any time in history, and any territorial acquisitions as a direct outcome or spin-off as a result of Arab attacks and warfare there. Now, there is another unique aspect you ought to look at, and that is this, that the Arab countries that surround Israel are not hostile in the traditional sense of hostility. That is, there is no disputed waterway, there is no disputed confluence of rivers, there are no displaced peoples in the traditional sense of the word, such as we may have had in the Sudetenland or things of that nature prior to World War II. There is no desire for any specific portion of the territory that belonged to the Israelis. There's no desire of their wealth or their resources, minerals, waterways, borders, in that sense of the word, the traditional reasons are lacking. The Arab hostility is unanimous in the sense that it desires the non-existence of Israel. It desires the extermination of Israel. Borders? The whole thing is the dispute over borders, Americans seem to think. Our news media continually tell us about the insistence of the Arabs that Israel return to the pre-1967 borders. But let's go back in time and get a little bit of perspective. Back before that time, with President Gamal Abdel Nasser in charge in Egypt, and now Anwar Sadat, his successor, the Israelis still had access up the Red Sea to the Gulf of Aqaba to their southern port of Eilat. The free shipping lanes were unimpeded. They were flowing along there. There was no threat to the economic development of Egypt. There was no imposition upon Egypt's territory. There was no sailing through waters claimed by Egypt. But it was simply announced over and over again by the Israeli government that any interference with free access of Israeli shipping, just like shipping of any other country, including ships going right across, visually you can see it. You can swim across easily, as people have done, to Aqaba, which is the only port city for the nation of Jordan. That was unimpeded and uninterrupted by the Israelis. They never made one gesture of any kind toward halting or stopping or interfering in any sense of the word with free shipping, including, which I saw with my own eyes when I was there, freighters coming from the United States and offloading U.S. General Patton tanks on the docks at Aqaba in clear sight with a pair of handheld binoculars right across from Eilat, which tanks were sold by the Americans to the Jordanian army, which in turn were used against Israel in the 67 war. Still, the Israelis did not ever interfere with free access to the port of Aqaba on the part of the Jordanians. Finally, Nasser decided to choke that off at the very same time that all of those weapons that I saw and reported on the World Tomorrow program from On the Spot Radio, done at Suez and done along the highway there, done at the pyramids and in the city of Cairo. I saw hundreds of tanks and I saw hundreds of field pieces and artillery and thousands of soldiers in temporary bivouacs all along the road leading out to Suez in 1966. And I said to the audiences then, war is just around the corner. I didn't know it was going to be next year. I didn't know it was going to be over so rapidly either. And maybe even the Israelis did not know that, but that's what happened. And at that time, Nasser's troops were massed in the Gaza Strip, up into the Sinai, and in a coordinated attack, the Syrians jumped off, as did the Egyptians, and in very short order, in 6 short days at the Midla Pass. As you know the story now, it's a matter of history. They were completely devastated. It took 3 days for any general in the Egyptian army to get up the courage to go to tell Gamal Abdel Nasser that his air force no longer existed. When he was asked by a correspondent at some time during the opening hostilities of the 67 war, why did you blockade Sharm el-Sheikh? Why did you blockade Israeli shipping flowing in open sea lanes to the port of Eilat? The answer was, because Nasser is a man.
Knowing the future has always proved difficult. The pilgrims envisioned a prosperous settlement, never dreaming their land would become the most powerful nation on earth. The Wright brothers predicted success, with no idea their new invention could be used this way. Henry Ford's automobile was a work of visionary genius, but he never expected this. What's coming next? Can you know? There is a source which accurately foretells the future of man, the Bible. Though much of Bible prophecy relates to our time, it remains a mystery to millions. You can know how coming world events will affect you. The keys to understanding Bible prophecy are explained in this free booklet, How to Understand Prophecy. Request your copy from Ambassador College, Box 111, Pasadena, California. In Canada, Box 44, Vancouver, BC.
Is it then just a dispute about borders? No, it is not, because the Israeli government is quick to point out that the borders which were enjoyed by the Syrians, the Jordanians, and the Egyptians in the pre-1967 war were not secure borders for Israel. They were being attacked almost daily from the Golan Heights. Israeli shipping was interdicted, intercepted. They were choked off. It would have been a partial economic strangulation by the act of Nasser to choke off shipping past Sharm el-Sheikh. And Nasser loaded the Gaza Strip and the Negev border at the Sinai with Israel with hundreds of tanks and launched an attack. So we could argue from now on about who wanted whose territory, and I think that history will still bear out the fact that the Israelis grabbed the territory only as a result of an attack that came to them which was unwanted. Now, whether you want to argue to that or not, that happens to be a fact. So at that time, the policy of the Arabs surrounding Israel was economic strangulation, it was embargoes, travel restriction, it was closed borders, and it was attempts at economic, military, political propaganda, and at the same time, terrorist acts within. After the 67 war, when Israel captured the West Bank, the Old City, the Golan Heights, and all of the Sinai, Egypt was rapidly rearmed. Along came a time of renewed warfare, which is now again history, in 1973, the famous Yom Kippur War. And this was a sign of new virility on the part, apparently, of Egyptian leadership, hailed as a tremendous victory because the war was going very badly this time against the Israelis. The attrition was enormous. The Israeli losses were very severe. President Nixon then, because I believe the State Department of the United States probably had at least some kind of guess, if not actual inside information, that the Israelis may have possessed limited tactical nuclear weapons, decided to support and to supply Israeli armed forces with whatever limited weapons, such as F-4 Phantoms and the like. You know the story now, the fact of transshipments of American military supplies from European borders, which in turn got the hostility from the Arabs so that they clamped down an embargo upon all of Europe. Originally, Europe puts pressure on us. We in turn put pressure back on Israel as a result of that. It was a kind of a gamble, yet even though it resulted in the economic disequilibrium of today, the Arab oil embargo as a result of that war and its disenchantment with the United States' support of Israel, let's go back and remember there were several unique things that occurred in the 1973 war. First, initially, the Egyptians and the Syrians had the advantage it was going very, very badly in the early days for the Israelis. You remember that. They were being killed by the dozens, the thousands. I guess it didn't go up quite that high, but at least they were losing hundreds of tanks, and they did lose an awful lot of aircraft, very expensive F-4s. Now, for the first time in all of history, spy satellites were used, daily launched by the Soviet Union to take pictures of the area and brought right back down the very same day. So long as the Egyptians were knifing up into the northern part of the Sinai, having successfully crossed the canal, the Soviet leadership didn't say a word. Mr. Kissinger was going back and forth all over the place to the Kremlin and down to Cairo and all over, as you know. That's all a matter of history. They were trying desperately to get the UN to get a ceasefire agreed to, and the fighting raged on day after day. Suddenly, the spy satellites of the Soviet Union determined something which the Egyptian leadership did not know and originally refused to believe. That is, that the Israelis had broached the canal down to the south. And instead of it being just some kind of a reconnaissance group, it was a whole army that had poured across down there, and the Egyptian Third Army was in danger of being cut off and surrounded. The moment the Soviet leadership found that out, they started trying to lean on the Egyptians and the Syrians to call for a ceasefire, and it began to put on pressure, and they went along with Mr. Kissinger's advice and with the UN, and they screamed for a ceasefire. But not until the war was going badly for their cohorts whom they had supplied with all of the equipment. Now, you remember, don't you, that the Israeli army had the Egyptian Third Army completely surrounded at Suez and literally could have annihilated them to the last man? Do we remember that after that time there was a kind of a realignment of a slight pullback by the Egyptians to the north and a complete pullback on the west bank of the Suez Canal by the Israelis? And then they even destroyed those earthen bridges and the pontoon bridges they had built. Now they're trying to clean up the canal. That's all open. Now the Israelis have been forced to withdraw back to some mountain passes, and instead of their forward defense line, which was right at the canal prior to this war, have taken up additional positions at prodigious cost. Now let's remember the perspective then. The Israelis gave and gave significantly at a moment when they could have taken the city of Cairo. But the war was stopped. The toll in human life was unacceptable. To Israel most especially, and really to either side, even though traditionally the Arabs have responded with the more or less unspoken thought that even though this is a temporary setback, the next time is going to be different, and the idea is that there are enough of us that eventually, if we can keep getting enough arms, that the attrition is going to wear Israel down first, and so finally we, the Arabs, will succeed in our policy of the extermination of Israel. Now, we come to the present. Here are the present borders. The Arabs are insisting the Israelis withdraw to the pre-1967 borders, and that seems to be the only way they will negotiate. Now, even if that were all they were talking about, look at these two enormously incredible, unbelievable preconditions to negotiation, which have been in the news so heavily that the Israelis are expected to go along with, and try if you can, even if you're an Arab, whatever you are, to try to see it from both points of view, without bias and without prejudice. These preconditions to negotiation are the following. One, the Egyptians have begun to insist that the Israelis cancel their program of immigration, which is the very reason for the being of the State of Israel, which is a homeland that always beckons to the Jewish people around the world in whatever country they may be found. A 50-year clampdown, a 50-year cutting off of that immigration policy. Can you imagine that? That's brand new. I mean, that's since any war. That's since the 73 Yom Kippur War. That's brand new, right out of the sky. How's that for tossing that out and making that another precondition to negotiation, even if they were willing to give up their advantage in the Golan Heights and Sharm el-Sheikh? Then we have another juicy little tidbit in the form of a fat little guy wagging his finger with his pistol in his holster, claiming to carry a freedom fighter's pistol in one hand and an olive branch in the other, wearing his tablecloth on his head, named Yasser Arafat, who suddenly sounds like he thinks he is the spokesman for the entirety of all the Arab countries, represents all of their oil wealth, and is even now taking issue with the power of the United States of America. Now the Israelis are expected not only to negotiate about the Golan Heights and Sharm el-Sheikh and the Sinai, but they're expected to negotiate with a man who instantly, upon learning that an American 17-year-old teenager whose only crime was to go with a group of Baptist church believers into an area where she thought Jesus Christ had been born at Bethany, and was boarding a bus, and was the only victim of a grenade which was tossed by some ferret-faced finky Arab over there, a dirty, bloodthirsty murderer of unarmed women and children, who tossed a grenade, and now that gal is minus a leg. She says there must have been some reason God had in mind. I don't know about that. I frankly doubt it, but if she believes that, that's fine. But the fact that this greasy little Nasser Arafat, I shouldn't say Nasser, but maybe Nasty Arafat, or Yasser Arafat, can, quote, take credit, end quote, for blasting this girl's leg off, and yet we in the United States do not speak out about that kind of thing, and he comes over here to this country, and then they have the greatest security measures in the history of the United Nations, with more preparation, more armed police and everything than they've ever had for any head of state in the history of the United Nations. And Arafat stands up and made his speeches, and now we seriously expect the Israelis to negotiate on these two bases? That they've got to deal with this murderer, this common criminal, with no country to call his own, who stands up and acts like he thinks he's a spokesman for the entirety of the Arab world? Nonsense! The Israelis are never going to do it. If we think peace is involved only in the Israeli unwillingness to give back some territory, we got to be crazy. We'd better look at it in the true perspective, in the overview of history of these last several years, and of the absolutely impossible preconditions to negotiation that these Arabs have added in the last very few months before any step-by-step negotiations could occur in that part of the earth. Now, at about the same time, the United Nations passed, because of a vote by Arab and Afro-Asian bloc membership over the protestations of the major industrial powers of the United States, of Britain, of West Germany, of France, of the Netherlands, of Belgium, of Italy, yes, and even Japan, all of these members. Because the United Nations is where the mighty are very, very small, and where they're very, very small, including some little tiny South Pacific island kingdom of practically nobody out there, has an equal vote. And so this big resolution they passed about nationalization of foreign industries was passed over the protestations of the United States and all the others. And I got on the radio at that time and I said something I'd like to repeat here for the television audience. Okay? The UN Afro-Asian bloc and the Arabs voted that they wanted to go along with the greatest rip-off in all of history. That's the nationalization of foreign investments abroad. Mostly, obviously, then aimed at U.S. possessions in Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and elsewhere in the Arab oil-rich parts of the world. So I got a suggestion. So let's nationalize the United Nations. After all, we paid for it. We've been paying the lion's share all the way along. You know, it's our building, basically, in the sense that we donated the soil there. Oh, I know, it's kind of a personal family deal and all that, but nevertheless, we could nationalize it. Let's nationalize the United Nations. It's not doing us any good anyway. I haven't the faintest idea what the United States is doing inside the United Nations. From the very word go, it was used as a communist sounding block for their empty propaganda. And today, it is even worse than that. Now we've got practically everybody in the act. Now a rotten criminal, an open, admitted murderer of unarmed women and children can come into the United Nations and wave his fat little pudgy finger in our faces and get away with it. And I have yet to this day not heard one single official statement of outrage that an American teenage girl had her leg blasted off at Bethany on the part of any American official in the State Department or elsewhere directed toward Yasser Arafat or any of the Arab leadership. Why? What are we afraid of? Well, we got our toys, you see. We've got our beautiful Corvettes and all this stuff. We got our toys. And we got to have gas for those toys. We don't want to upset those Arabs. I mean, they might cut off our oil. We'd have been so much better off back in the early days of the energy crisis when they cut off the oil to say, keep it. Stop right there. Don't take another drop. Why get hooked on it like a drug addict? Just leave the oil in the Middle East where it is. The United States can develop more of its own. Well, you know, we could build automobiles to last 10 years instead of two, and we could build automobiles to get double the mileage we do, triple the mileage we do if we wanted to, but we don't, and we probably won't. We could also decide, you know, just like wartime, not to even manufacture automobiles for 2 years in a row. Something of this nature. Oh, a lot of things we could do. All kinds of options open to us. We could have learned, just like we were beginning to cancel trips and to slow down on our travel, and we could have just learned. We were already well into learning what it meant to have an almost wartime restriction on travel and on fuel and rising costs. But instead, we wanted to have our pie in the sky, our ethereal, unreal world, and keep our toys. And instead of learning to really live with that situation, now we're right back like the addict who was halfway through a methadone program, and it didn't work, and he's back completely hooked, and he's worse than he ever was. Now it seems we're more dependent than ever before, so now we're trying to lean on the Israelis to give in to all these concessions, and we expect that they're going to do it. Let me tell you, they are not going to do it. And the Middle East is the most important place on the face of this earth for you to watch. I have said on this program, and many people will remember I said it, and I said it literally dozens of times. I said words to this effect even coming on the beginning of the program. During the mid-60s, I said, the time is coming around the corner in the very near future when American concern and preoccupation over the Middle East is going to pale into insignificance our worry over Vietnam. That day has arrived. And if you want to keep up on these meaningful events in the light of Bible prophecy, you need your name on the mailing list of The Plain Truth. It's a new, now, twice-monthly periodical coming out in newsprint and in tabloid size that gives you meaningful, straight-from-the-shoulder, plain talk just the way this program does, which is what sets it apart and makes it different from anything else on television or the radio. And that's why I hope a lot of people, even if they don't get mad, they like to watch it. Write for this booklet, too, on how to understand prophecy. It's free of charge, as is The Plain Truth. All you need to do is to send your request to me, Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California, and we'll send it to you by return mail free of charge. Until next time, Garner Ted Armstrong, goodbye, friends.
All literature offered on the Garner Ted Armstrong program is free upon request. Write Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California, 91123. Canadian viewers write Box 44, Vancouver, B.C. In the continental United States, you may call this toll-free number, 800-423-4444. That's 800-423-4444. In California, call 213-577-5225. Be sure to watch Garner Ted Armstrong again next week at this same time.